Confessions crash into the markets this week. Wall Street under fire. Congress analyzes the analysts. And a childish look at investing. How parents can talk to their kids about money. From New York, E-Trade On Air is next.
From the E-Trade Center on 55th and Madison Avenue in New York City, I'm E-Trade On Air's Kate Bonner.
And I'm Jonathan Honig, Portfolio Manager at Capitalist Pig Asset Management. We're also joined, as always, by Tom Hudson from WebFN. Guys, we're all here at the E-Trade Center in New York City, and what a week it was. I mean, Hudson, between Honeywell and GE, Nortel and JDSU, this was quite a volatile week.
This really was the confessions week when the second quarter confessions begun to come to roost down on Wall and Broad Streets in Lower Manhattan. A lot of big companies there warning about the second quarter. Certainly no surprise, but still hitting those stock prices.
On Friday, there was a rumor that Microsoft might miss its earnings target. But, Kate, you actually took a look at Oracle this week.
Yeah, not many bright spots in the tech sector this week. But on Friday morning, it looked like Oracle might see a little bump in the stock. It was up about a half a buck after Larry Ellison, the CEO over there, on Thursday night unveiled the new database to much fanfare. But, sadly, Oracle closed down about $2 for the week.
We did have an IPO. Kraft went public this week. Second biggest IPO in history, came public under ticker symbol KFT. We're going to talk about that a little later in the show. It actually closed under its IPO range, but this was hot from the start.
It was hot from the start, and it was oversold. It actually came in at the top end of the range at $31 a share, but it got caught up in a little bit of that market sell-off and some negativity around several big-cap stocks, and Kraft Foods here actually closed down below its IPO price in its first few days of trading.
For the week, the Dow lost 3%, the Nasdaq down by 8%, and the S&P falling 4% in what was a very, very busy week. We got a hot show coming right your way, so please stay tuned. You're listening to E-Trade On Air. Guys, no one has to hide their feelings about analysts on this show, right? I mean, these analysts, they're the ones who love Cisco at 80 and strong buy on pets.com at 70, and then maybe they just downgrade it to a neutral when it hits 2.
Qualcomm at 1,000.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the analysts, we've always talked about it. They seem to be wrong again and again and again, and this week that was an issue that even Congress took up. Hearings on Capitol Hill, and among those testifying was our next guest, Benjamin Mark Cole, wrote the book called The Pied Pipers of Wall Street, How Analysts Sell You Down the River. And he, in fact, was among those testifying in front of Congress on Friday. So tell us about the hearings. What happened? What did you say?
Well, I have to tell you, I was tremendously impressed with the chairman of the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Capital Markets, Richard Baker from Louisiana. You know, I'm from Los Angeles, and I kind of thought, well, I can barely understand Wall Street. What's some guy from Louisiana going to know? So when I got there and I testified, I discovered through his questioning that the chairman, Richard Baker of Louisiana, is totally on top of Wall Street. He's well aware of the conflicts of interest that analysts have. He even lambasted the industry and said that the conflict of interest standards which apply to real estate brokers in Louisiana, which was his own profession, were higher than the ethical standards proposed by the SIA, Securities Industry Association.
Let's go into depth now a bit about those conflicts of interest. I mean, You are not a fan of the analysts at all. Your book supposedly exposes how Wall Street analysts sell people down the river. How do they do that?
Well, it's easy to find a lot of evidence how they do that. The problem is that the industry today, unlike 25 years ago, makes the most of its money, it makes its real profits in investment banking, unlike 25 years ago when it made its money in retail trading. Therefore, the important customer today is not the individual investor. The important customer is the corporate client, the client that needs an underwriting, a bond underwriting, an initial public offering of stock, or a secondary offering. So when analysts today put out reports, they're not worried about the retail trade client. They don't make any money on individual investors. They make their big money on the underwritings and even taking stock pre-IPO in a company, private equity, and that stock can become extraordinarily valuable after the IPO, as we saw in 1999 and 2000. So the simple answer is analysts report to the investment banking departments today, and therefore their reports always say buy.
Benjamin, this is Tom Hudson. Why does any of this matter? The analysts don't take any kind of version of the Hippocratic Oath that they're going to tell the truth and nothing but the truth when they took a look at these companies.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could just say caveat emptor, investor beware, but you have to understand, the analysts are given a great deal of credibility by the financial media. They're quoted on the airwaves. Their opinions appear in print. They are backed by powerful advertising campaigns. The ability to create credibility, Wall Street has that ability. Maybe you're a bunch of smart guys there in New York, and maybe market professionals know it's a bunch of hoo-ha. They don't know it out there in America. They believe the analysts. And if the investing public loses faith in Wall Street, if it stops investing, we're all going to pay a high price in inferior capital markets.
Kate Bonner here. Is any of this going to make any difference, these hearings? When or if we head back into a bull market, will everyone just forget all about this and just start upgrading stocks again?
Well, yeah, I think they might. But I think we're going to be surprised. At least I'm going to be surprised. What I saw from Congress on Thursday, the very intelligent line of questioning pursued by Chairman Baker. And I understand that Paul Sarbanes, a senator from Maryland, may hold similar hearings in the future. And then Harvey Pitt, President Bush's proposed SEC chairman, he's going to face a real buzzsaw questioning, I understand, on this topic. Are analysts conflicted? Is Wall Street analysis corrupt? Congress believes it is corrupt, and I think this issue is really going to blow.
Benjamin, didn't we get an admission from the Association for Investment Management and Research at the hearings that you attended and you spoke at on Thursday on Capitol Hill that, in fact, yes, Wall Street analysts are pressured into making positive recommendations?
Yeah, you can imagine if an industry body admits to that much, it's really saying the whole system's totally corrupt. And I think Congress is convinced of that. It's going to be a pointed and heavy issue which falls into the lap of Harvey Pitt. What are you going to do about this? I don't know how he's going to dodge this issue. He's in a tough spot.
Whether there's a conflict or interest or not, I tell you, these analysts are actually terrible stock pickers. There was a new study out this week by four California professors. They concluded that the stocks that were most highly recommended by analysts last year actually underperformed the market by about 31%. Now, the stocks that were least favorably recommended by the analysts, you know, the sells and the neutrals and the underperforms, those actually outperformed the market by almost 50%.
Guys, the study says if you would have bought when analysts said sell, you would have done much better than if you would have bought when the analyst said buy. But Benjamin, let me ask you about this. Don't studies like these go a long way to kind of break down that inherent credibility that you talked about earlier, that Wall Street is able to kind of market that analysts have to the investing communities?
Well, I think investors will become smarter over time. I mean, I think it's going to be quite a while before they jump on a buy recommendation of Henry Blodgett like they did on his buy recommendation of Amazon.com a couple of years ago. But you got to remember, a lot of ordinary folk go in and talk to their stockbrokers, and their stockbrokers tell them to buy stocks which are recommended by the analysts at that firm. And those stockbrokers are under pressure by their branch office managers to push those stocks. So you have a very serious institutionalized problem on Wall Street. Stockbrokers are expected to move the stock that their investment banking departments have underwritten, or if they want business with that company in the future, or if the brokerage owns stock in that company, or even if the brokerage is owned by a commercial bank which has relationships with the company. So you can say, well, investors are going to wise up, but what about the lady that goes and talks to her stockbroker and he recommends that stock? It's a serious problem. It's not one to be winked away. Sure, you guys in New York, you might know the score, but they don't know it across the country, and it's a serious problem.
What do you think of the validity of the guidelines released by the Securities Industry Association on Tuesday?
Oh, they're pretty soft pap. And even the AMIR, the other industry body of analysts, dismissed them as saying we've had tougher standards for 35 years. And as I said, Chairman Baker snorted at those standards and said we have tougher standards for real estate brokers in Louisiana. So I don't think anybody's taking the SIA recommendation seriously at all.
Isn't there school thought that says, you know what, at the end of the day, buyer beware? You know, two sides make a market. No one knows what these stocks are going to do. And an analyst recommendation, truthfully, should be just one component of the research people do when it comes to buying stocks. I mean, heck, Tom, there's more research on the net now available for free. So maybe people, frankly, should blame themselves if they're only just listening to, well, if Mary Meeker likes, then I should buy it. Well, what about the school that says, hey, do your own homework?
Well, if the decision's being made weren't so darn serious, that might be an okay school of thought. You know, you go to the store and buy some cookies, you don't like them, well, you get a different set of cookies next time. But we don't allow people to go to quack cancer clinics in this country. We don't allow people to decide what kind of medical care they're going to have when they go in for brain surgery. They have to go to a licensed physician in a licensed hospital. Same sort of thing applies to your retirement savings of people across this nation. They don't have the skill set necessary to be expert stock selectors. We have to have standards within this industry. And besides which, do you really want an industry where people lie all the time to the public and we say that's okay? I don't think that's what we want on Wall Street.
Benjamin, let me ask you one final question here. How do you see this debate winding up, especially when it comes to the possibility of legislation of the regulation of Wall Street analysts?
Well, if you asked me before Thursday, I would have said nothing's going to come of this. I'll probably travel to Washington. I'll waste my time. I'll blow hot air around and leave town. And so will all the other people who testify. But again, the line of questioning followed by even members of the Republican Party, the wholesale dismissal of the proposal put together by the Securities Industry Association, tells me that Congress is angry about this topic and that this topic's going to come up again at Harvey Pitt's confirmation hearings. He's going to run into a buzzsaw on this issue, and investors are angry. Besides, they saw the NASDAQ collapse in half, and what analyst told you were going to lose half your money on the NASDAQ in less than a year? We still got a market that's trading at 30 times earnings going into a recession. It's going to be a tough sled for Wall Street the next couple of years in terms of legislation and regulation.
We've been speaking with Benjamin Mark Cole. He is author of the book, The Pied Pipers of Wall Street. And it's time for the ticker test here in E-Trade On Air. Guys, Kraft went public this week, although fell below the IPO price, Tom.
It did fall below the IPO price. Last trade on Friday, $30.60, $40 below the initial public price.
One of my favorite Kraft products is Kool-Aid. Kate, you look like kind of a Kool-Aid woman.
As Mr. Hudson would say, I have my Kool-Aid mustache on all the time.
Well, there's 20 flavors of Kool-Aid powdered soft drink that are currently available, but what's the most popular flavor? Is it tropical punch, lemonade, cherry, or grape? Take a guess right now and email us at etradeonair@etrade.com. We'll have the answer coming up a little later in the show.
Still to come here at E-Trade On Air, Dead or Alive, GE and Honeywell, and the European Commission. Also, we'll spend an investor minute with Chris Chan. Stay tuned. E-Trade On Air, we'll be right back.
Our users come to us not only on a regular basis, but also during severe weather, whether it's snowstorms, landfall, hurricanes, tornadoes.
Weather.com is an IBM e-business.
I'm Mark Ryan, Chief Technology Officer of Weather.com, the internet arm of the Weather Channel.
As a top 25 website, Weather.com needs a top e-business infrastructure.
We may need to scale to 30 million page views within 2 days. We update our maps every 15 minutes in most cases.
IBM helps Weather.com on many fronts.
We needed a very robust infrastructure, hardware, software, but also the integration skills. IBM came to the table with their infrastructure parts, including Linux servers. We not only update the information, but also serve it back to our customers at a very high volume. IBM enabled us to achieve this goal.
Visit ibm.com/ebusiness for more information on IBM eBusiness infrastructure.
IBM is a valued infrastructure business partner of weather.com.
Hi, I'm the laziest guy in the world. Really? Today I had dinner with two friends, the richest guy in the world and the nicest guy in the world. The nicest guy in the world said he had to tell us about the E-Trade Mutual Fund Center. Richest guy in the world said, make it quick, time is money. The nicest guy in the world said that E-Trade Power Search can scrutinize over 5,000 mutual funds. He really had our attention. Well, except when the sexiest woman in the world walked by our table. I especially like the part about being able to do all this using a laptop in bed. Just answer some simple questions, and E-Trade gives me a list of the funds that match my goals. And just then the bill came. Turned out the richest guy in the world is also the cheapest guy in the world. He didn't even pick up the check. The nicest guy in the world did. Take my advice. Enjoy a nice 4-hour nap. Then roll over and visit mutualfunds.etrade.com or call 1-800-ETRADE-1. Now, I can't promise you'll be the richest guy in the world. That role's taken. But you won't be the dumbest guy in the world. E-Trade Securities, Inc., member NASDS, SIPC, response and access times may vary due to market system and other conditions. Power search is limited to mutual funds available in E-Trade Mutual Fund Center. Oh, forgive me, the fastest stock in the world didn't show.
AIGDirect.com presents Don't Be Fuelish, useful tips on how you can improve your car's gas mileage. Make tire pressure a priority. Underinflated tires are the number one cause of avoidable fuel loss. Also check your brakes. A maladjusted or stuck parking brake can hamper your car's fuel efficiency. Improving your car's gas mileage can save you money. For more useful tips and a free auto insurance quote, visit AIGDirect.com. AIGDirect.com, the online source for buying auto insurance.
Frustrated by the IRS Schedule D and filing taxes for your investments? Let Gainskeeper.com help solve your capital gains tax headaches. Gainskeeper automatically adjusts for wash sales and corporate actions. Keep your gains. Log on to Gainskeeper.com today.
Welcome back to E-Trade On Air with Kate Bonner, Jonathan Honig, and WebFN News anchor Tom Hudson. Time now for some useless information. Want to hear the very first recording of a human voice?
Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
That's right, Mary Had a Little Lamb was the best General Electric founder Thomas Edison could come up with when he put a screw down on some tinfoil, turned a cylinder, and shouted into a cone, creating the phonograph. Sadly, this isn't the silliest thing Edison ever recorded. After a lackluster attempt to sell the invention as a letter dictating machine called the Ediphone, he realized there might be some commercial uses for the music industry, and his marketing plan included the Edison Phonograph Polka.
Well, I bet you the current CEO of General Electric would like to put the screw to the tinfoil of the European Commission with this Honeywell deal hanging out there in the wind.
Well, the piece we just heard gets to the point, really, that GE, it just isn't any old company. GE is the only company still from the original Dow Jones Industrials, and it is a monster of a company. It is the biggest component of the S&P 500. Kate, they've paid dividends every quarter since 1899. And one share of General Electric purchased way back in 1926 is now worth 4,608 shares. This is a company that makes big money, Kate. 2,000 revenues of $129 billion. Billion dollars.
And gentlemen, if this deal does indeed die, which it looks like it is going to lead an ugly death, it would mark the first time that European regulators have killed a merger between two American companies that U.S. officials have already approved.
I mean, not only is, you know, the business on the line, there's a lot of pride on the line. Jack Welch, of course, the outgoing CEO of General Electric, you got a lot of pride on the line with the Department of Justice in the United States that has already okayed this deal. You've got the United States Trade Representative in force of this thing. You have the U.S. Attorney General sending lieutenants over to Brussels and the head of the EC to talk to some of these people. You got President Bush making comments
and
about this.
And don't forget Mario Monti, the European regulator.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's play a little bit of what if, though, guys. What if this thing actually does die on the vine? I mean, right now, GE has said it has its best last offer on the table. The EC, the European Commission, has about a month now to look it over before they rule on whether or not GE can buy out Honeywell. But let's play worst-case scenario for GE, and in fact, the deal is squelched, and Jack Welch has to walk away from the table. What happens to General Electric after that, Jonathan?
Well, we saw General Electric rise this week, Tom. You know, I mean, a lot of the arbitrage community that plays these merger opportunities have been short shares of General Electric, long shares of Honeywell, and we really saw that trade got unwound this week when Honeywell fell precipitously on Thursday. I believe it was down something like 12% for a Dow stock. That's a huge move. We saw GE rise a bit on the news. But you know what else was a big loser, interestingly enough, was United Technologies. As rumors swirling around that maybe if GE doesn't pick up Honeywell, UTX could. And United Technologies was down sharply on that news as well.
And you know, Jack Welch did indeed snatch Honeywell out from the arms of UTX. So wouldn't be surprising if they step back up to the plate.
But Hudson, your point is well taken. General Electric is a big important company owned by people as part of mutual funds. It's the largest component of the S&P 500. I mean, this is a bellwether stock in the best sense.
No doubt about it. And you got to ask then, what happens to GE after this? GE obviously made a play for Honeywell to grow its bottom line, to grow its business. So thus, are we having to look at a slower growth picture for General Electric if the Honeywell deal doesn't go through?
Well, one thing is the incoming CEO, Jeffrey Immelt, he would have had a huge task trying to integrate these two companies. Jack Welch was really just going to stay for the pure acquisition, but it was going to be up to Jeffrey Immelt to actually do the transition. So maybe he'll be able to focus a little bit more on his core strategy.
I got to tell you guys, I'm a trader and I'm short General Electric here. It is one of our largest positions from a you know, from a fundamental perspective, and I hate the fundamental perspective, Tom, as you know, but how this company trades is an unsustainable multiple in my book. Something like 36 times earnings, 10 times book. It's an expensive stock any way you cut it, but hey, that's just one man's opinion. You're logged into E-Trade on air.
Time now for the E-Trade Investor Minute, our daily look at personal finance. Today, what happens to your stocks when the company goes bankrupt? In volatile markets, it's important to know how to salvage what you have. E-Trade On Air correspondent Chris Chan has the story.
Maintaining proper records may be the most important thing you do when you own shares of a company that goes bankrupt. Financial planner Ben Udley in Oregon says proof of your stock ownership serves many purposes.
You can get a letter from your broker, or you can contact the Secretary of State to verify that and get some documents. Because the next thing you'll do is take a complete loss on your taxes, and you'll need to be able to tell the IRS for certain that the company's gone bankrupt.
You can also file what's called a worthless securities form with your broker, which will enable you to close your position at a nominal price and declare the loss. Besides tax reasons, your document can also serve as education.
If you have the certificate in your hands, the best thing to do is frame it and hang it on your wall as a reminder to buy only profitable, fundamentally sound companies in the future. And you never can tell. Sometimes these things reorganize and they come back to life, in which case you'd still have the securities.
If the company files for Chapter 11, it has the ability to reorganize and remain in business. But if it files for Chapter 7 bankruptcy, the company is forced to liquidate all assets. I'm Chris Chan with the E-Trade Investor Minute.
Our correspondent Chris Chan really has a good point when he talks about maintaining proper records. I just saw an interview with the coach of the Baltimore Ravens, who's written a new book about how to be fiercely competitive in this very fiercely competitive environment. And he talks about the power of organizational skills.
Listen, there's a lot of bankrupt companies out there, unfortunately. People are holding them. Some of these stocks that maybe Hudson back in March of 2000, they sounded like great ideas and interesting business plans, but somewhere along the line, and I'm sure the analysts love them up there, right?
Probably. They had a difficult time actually deciphering the business plans because they're back of a cocktail napkin, perhaps. One option, though, that Ben Utley wisely did not include was the wallpaper option for some of those worthless stock certificates,
yeah,
right?
Put it up on the wall and say, why did I buy that again? You know, one thing also to keep in mind is, you know, we talk all the time about the dangers of playing what are so-called penny stocks. Stocks trade that, you know, literally pennies or even $1, $2 a share. I mean, you have to know when a company gets down to that level, the life support world of securities, you know, is trading at 60 cents, 70 cents. You got to know that something's up here. This isn't exactly a blue chip. So you got to have your radar out for that one.
Let me ask you one quick organizational question. You're a money manager. Do you know where your stock certificates are, Jonathan?
Thankfully, being in custody with my broker, I don't know better than to actually hold onto them myself. If you've seen my office, you know exactly why, Hudson.
Guys, stick around. Still more to come here at E-Trade On Air. A little bit of personal finance. Uncle Sam is getting ready to send out those tax rebate checks soon. Some tips, perhaps, on what to do with the money. We're from New York this weekend. Stick around. E-Trade On Air. We'll be right back.
Imagination. Now, back to E-Trade On Air from the E-Trade Center in the heart of New York City at 55th and Madison with your host Jonathan Honig, Kate Bonner, and WebFN news anchor Tom Hudson.
President George W. Bush's tax cut was met with great fanfare. $1.35 trillion. Gentlemen, didn't it sound like so much money?
It's difficult to get all those zeros in there, though, isn't it?
Exactly. Then the news hit hard that single folks would maybe get a check for $300. Couples would perhaps receive $600. The question remains, what should we do with that check when we hopefully receive it sometime this summer? Well, joining us on the line is Rick Edelman. He's a certified financial planner and author of Ordinary People, Extraordinary Wealth. Rick, welcome to E-Trade on Air.
How are you?
Well, so Rick, what should we do with the money?
Spend it.
Rick, in all honesty, most financial planners would caution folks to save the money and not go out and, you know, blow it on a new Dolce & Gabbana shirt.
Yeah, I guess it is silly for a financial advisor to say to people, go ahead and spend this windfall. But frankly, that's exactly what the president wants you to do. Remember, the whole basis for this tax cut is that the economy is faltering, that we're slowing down and sluggish, and the government has excess money. Well, we don't want the government to spend our own money. We can do that ourselves, thank you very much. So take this money, put it back into the economy by spending so that we can jolt this economy back into good health. That's
Rick,
the theory,
it's Tom
anyway.
Hudson. $300, though, that's not a windfall. Come on, $300.
Well, they think it's a lot of money in Washington for some reason. I don't know. I mean, that's half a toilet seat at the Pentagon. Give me a break.
Rick, so do you think it will work? It will stimulate the economy?
Absolutely. It'll be we're going to dump hundreds of millions of dollars into the economy when these checks start rolling, but of course, it's going to be extremely short-lived. Guess what happens after we've spent that $300? The economy's going to go right back to where it was, so I really don't know that the long-term impact is going to be very good.
Hey, Rick, it's Jonathan Honig. Thanks again for joining us. You're always a fun guest. But come on, spend it. I mean, at a time in which we know the personal savings rate is negative, a lot of people have money on a credit card balance that they're carrying. That's, of course, I mean, isn't there a bit more productive way than to just blow the $300 on something trite? I mean, what about paying down a credit card debt? Would that be a better use of it maybe than spending it?
Naturally, you're absolutely right. I'm being rather facetious when I say this. And so you should be as prudent as possible with this money like you would any other money. If you have credit card debts, pay them off. Personal loans, student loans, auto loans, use this money to get rid of the debts that you've got. Mortgages are okay to keep, but other personal debts, absolutely get rid of them. If you don't have enough cash reserves, this money should be used for that purpose. Just keep in mind that if we don't spend this money, we are not going to be giving the economy the boost that the president says he's expecting us to give.
Yeah, and I guess, Kate, that new Palm Pilot's kind of winking at me over at Radio Shack.
The color Palm Pilot.
Now, here's the real question I have. Granted, we're getting $300 or $600 checks in the mail, but I want to know is, how much money is it going to cost for the government to issue those 91 million checks? How many of those checks are going to get lost in the mail? How many will be stolen? How many will be never cashed? What happens if you move between now and when the checks are issued and you never find your check? Wasn't there a cheaper, easier way to distribute this money?
It just seems like it's rife with the option for fraud. Yeah,
a lot of money flying around.
I got a pothole in Lower Wacker that I'll put my $300 in if they fix the darn thing. You know what I'm talking about?
So, Rick, I have a financial advisor question for you. Put on your financial advisor hat. Do I buy a new pair of Nikes or do I buy 3 shares of Pfizer?
I would much rather that you buy stock instead of goods. And I say that often, especially in my book, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Wealth. I say, look, instead of buying a six-pack of beer, buy stock in the company instead, in Anheuser-Busch. Instead of buying a Coke, buy stock in Coca-Cola. Buy something that will give you a return on your money, and that's always a better choice.
Rick, let's talk about the market briefly. Not a great week for any of the major indices. The Dow off about 3%, and the Nasdaq, again, taking it on the chin, losing 8%. I mean, stocks like JDS Uniphase, Nortel Networks, popular stocks that a lot of individual investors own, all made fresh new 52-week lows on Friday. Where are you looking in the market now to pick up some bargains?
There's really nowhere exactly. We think that we're in the summer doldrums, and I think that we're going to go drifting for the next several months well into August and until we get out of Labor Day. So this is really our attitude is if you're invested, sit tight, don't expect much to happen. If you've got cash sitting on the sidelines, now is as good a time as any to invest because I think we're going to drift, and I don't really think we're going to see anything exciting in either direction for the next couple of months.
Rick, real quickly, where are you going to spend your chunk of change?
You know, that's a great question. I'm not sure I've really given it a lot of thought. I have a feeling, knowing me and my wife, that we will spend it on going out to dinner.
I'm going for that color Palm Pilot. Thanks for joining us today, Rick.
Thanks.
We've been speaking with Rick Edelman. He's a certified financial planner and author of Ordinary People, Extraordinary Wealth.
You know, guys, Rick does make an interesting point, and that being, you know, perhaps if you do spend the money, it could be a stimulus to the economy. The reason why is because consumer spending is such a huge portion of the United States economy. It's more than two-thirds responsible for the gross domestic product, and when consumers continue to spend, it will help the economy out. But Rick also does make the point that, listen, it may not be all that long-lived.
You guys are going to be spending on gasoline out of Chicago.
Rick seems to suggest that it's like our personal responsibility to hold the nation's economy on our shoulders.
But don't we, with two-thirds of the responsibility of the gross domestic product on the shoulders and the pocketbooks and the purses of the United States consumer?
That's a very good point, Tom. And indeed, we'll have to see where that money goes, whether it's be $300 or $600. Maybe it will find its way back into the market. Who knows? Lots to talk about still, so stay tuned. You're tuned into E-Trade On Air.
Still to come, talking with kids about money, and we'll talk with one big kid about money, the CEO of BeyondTheBull.com, Greg Timmel. He's just around the corner right here at E-Trade On Air.
E-Trade On Air, news about your money. Now from E-Trade Center in New York, here's Kate Bonner.
How early do you start to talk to your kids about money? E-Trade On Air's Amy Ruffalo went out on the streets of Chicago to find out what you're thinking.
As soon as they're old enough to understand me.
Before they were five?
It's probably about eight. They was probably at the age where they should be concerned about their funds.
I can't remember that. Probably before their teens.
Probably around eight.
About time they're 2.5, 3.
Teenagers, 12, 13.
And what was the first topic you talked to them about concerning money?
Whatever you earn, really appreciate it. Don't take it for granted. It's yours to do with what you think is right.
Allowance and how you earn money.
Saving.
Try to always have a little money in your pocket. You know, never walk around with no money. So if you have to call somebody or something, you know, it was a grown-up thing. They're pretty good like that.
How to invest into the market. Well, they've got a dividend reinvestment plan.
How they have to earn what they want to buy. So if they take all their birthday money and blow it on one thing, that's it. But they have to take half their birthday money and put it in a bank account, and then they can spend some of their money.
How much things cost?
We were just speaking with Rick Edelman, and in one of his books, he identifies sort of the nine most important factors that will give you extraordinary wealth. And one of them is start talking to your kids really early about money.
Kids certainly know how much things cost. They can see it. I've got a couple young cousins, 4 or 5 years old. Say, Hudson, they love pennies, dimes, and nickels. Of course, they just think they're kind of little shiny trinkets. But they certainly are aware of what money is. I don't think they know too much about saving yet. But you got to start early with young people.
Well, you do have to start early. Maybe not 4 or 5 a.m., perhaps right around the time that the opening bell rings is about the time, right?
That's about early in the day, early in their lives.
Right, right. They certainly have to be aware of what money is, yes. And you're right. I think kids do definitely know what a dollar is. But it is up to mom and dad to kind of show them the value of that dollar and certainly explain the magic of compound interest.
Now I know I am completely broke. My parents never talked to me about money at all.
When I was a kid, we had books like Good Night Moon or Winnie the Pooh books. I don't know, some of the Aesop's Fables and whatnot.
When you got a little older, it was Judy Blume books and those types of things.
Exactly.
Little House on the Prairie.
Exactly. You've been going through my reading list lately. No, but there's a new book out. Now that's a children's book about Wall Street. Its author, Amy Doherty, joins us now. She is the author of Rory's Random Walk Down Wall Street. Amy, thank you for joining us. Welcome to E-Trade On Air.
Thanks for having me on.
The book title itself, Rory's Random Walk Down on Wall Street, it's a play on another very popular book about Wall Street called A Random Walk Down Wall Street. Why a children's book about Wall Street?
Well, the impetus for me writing it really was that I worked on Wall Street for many years, and when I left to have children, I realized that there were no children's books to teach my kids about what I used to do for a living. And I think, you know, we've gone from a saving society to an investing society, and yet, from what I can tell, money and investing is not widely taught in our schools, and I think that's because it's a very complicated topic. And so my goal in writing this book, and I have young children, so I sort of geared it toward my younger children in the picture book format, was just to introduce them to a complicated topic at an early age so that maybe it won't be as scary for them later in life.
And paging through it, Amy, you really know that you used to work on Wall Street because all the characters are names like Morgan and Merrill and Chase, all names and references from actual Wall Street firms. So what is an appropriate age for parents to sit down and begin talking to their children about financial markets and about saving?
Well, I think even as early as 3, you can start talking to your children about money as a medium of exchange. You know, when you go to the grocery store, you can have them count out the change that you get back at the cash register. When you're in a restaurant, you can pull out, you know, all the coins in your pocket and start to talk about the different, you know, differences between the different coins. And then I think by the age of 10, really, you can start saving and investing with your children. And you know, look at the local business section of your paper in the morning, if you can, over breakfast, and start to follow a few companies and talk about how current events affect those companies and maybe do some research online. Kids are usually more internet savvy than their parents, and so, you know, maybe it's something that you can do together and learn together.
Amy, it's Tom Hudson. You've mentioned the phrases a couple of times. I just want to get a couple of quick definitions for you. Saving, sure, and investing.
Saving, to me, is you know, putting your money into an account and actually watching it get interest, and the whole, like you were saying, the compound interest, you know, that you earn interest on interest, and that's a pretty powerful thing over the long time horizon that kids have. Investing to me would be, you know, buying some sort of an asset, whether it be stock, a bond.
Amy, Kate Bonner here. As a parent, should you be aware of sort of talking to your kids about Wall Street, but creating a monster like this 15-year-old that was day trading his way to $250,000 when SEC came down on him?
That's a great question. And actually, when I was doing research for the book, I brought my illustrator to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange just so she could get a feel for what it looked like. And all the traders down there were saying, great, you're going to create all these new day traders in the future.
but Amy, kids are natural traders, aren't they? I mean, if it's not marbles or baseball cards, it's Pokemon cards. I mean, don't kids naturally barter and trade?
That's exactly right. In fact, my 4-year-old the other day said to me, Mom, I'll give you $100 if you don't put me in timeout. So, you know, they get the whole idea of bartering, and they, you know, I think the other thing that you can show is that trading, in the book, one of the characters says trading is a lot more fun than just plain old sharing. And I think, you know, kids are always taught to share everything, but if you trade, you get something back in return, which is sort of a neat concept for kids.
Speaking of trading, what types of stocks or what particular stocks or even sectors would you suggest maybe parents do buy for their kids?
Well, I, you know, definitely am not an expert on this. I'm sure you have lots of people on who have a lot better ideas, but just general themes that I would recommend are, you know, the buy and hold strategy, reinvesting your dividends, buying high quality companies, you know, the normal, you know, strong earnings growth, great management, great market share, having some diversity in your portfolio. And one thing I think with kids is buy what you know, which is the Peter Lynch mantra. So when you're out shopping with them, you can say, you know, do you think Walmart has a great product mix, or do you think Happy Meals are a good idea at McDonald's? So you can sort of incorporate it into your daily life and make it more interesting for the kids.
One of the more popular funds that has come up in recent years has been that Steinrow Young Investor Fund. Hudson, I know you're familiar with it. It's a mutual fund that really targets, I don't know if it's the right word, it caters to young people interested in investing, and everything from the prospectus to the information that's sent about the types of companies, it's fascinating. It's really geared towards young people.
It really is. And Amy, do you see the mutual fund industry perhaps beginning to market itself now toward younger investors?
Oh, definitely. In fact, well, the Young Investor Fund has been around for quite a long time, but and they have a great website for kids, too, called younginvestor.com, where you can ask Dr. Tightwad your money questions, and they have games on there. But definitely, I think, you know, they're starting to market more to kids, not as young as my book is geared toward, but, you know, if you look on CNBC, how many kids call in and ask questions, you know, and taking stock and such that are, you know, 10 and 12 years old. It's amazing.
Thank you for joining us, Amy. Congratulations on the book. It's called Rory's Random Walk Down Wall Street. Our guest has been Amy Doherty.
We're going to check in with a couple of big kids of our own. Our resident stock picker, Market Surfer, will be along after the break, as will Greg Timmel, CEO of Beyond the Bull, for some stock talk and ticker tests still to come later on in the hour. Stick around. It's E-Trade On Air.
Welcome back to E-Trade On Air, hosted by Jonathan Honig, Kate Bonner, and WebFN news anchor Tom Hudson.
Oil stocks were hot on Friday after some positive research out of Bank of America. They like a couple of names like ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, Schlumberger, a couple there. Although not a great week for the Dow. It was off by 3%, the NASDAQ off by 8%. Time now for Market Surfer here on E-Trade On Air. Dave Goodboy, of course, is his real name, but he goes by screen name Market Surfer. Always out there keeping an eye out for stocks off the radar screen, unusual names. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Jonathan. Dr. Tightwad. I love that name. Hey, I wanted to find a way to profit from the carnage happening in corporate America, and my search led me to my pick, EPIC Systems. ticker symbol EPIQ. These guys develop, market, and license software for Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcy trustees and other users of the federal bankruptcy system. So the company has been profiting very nicely from the current wave of bankruptcies, and I believe it will continue to do so.
Dave, this stock started out 2001 somewhere near $10 a share. It now trades for over $35 a share. Not a bad return there, but can it keep that performance up?
I believe it can. I mean, it's been in a steady uptrend since October of last year. The revenues are up substantially. In fact, they're up 43% the last quarter, and the income is up over five times the last quarter. And this strong uptrend, I just believe it's going to continue, and it looks like a really good buy right here.
David Hudson, isn't this a bit kind of a depressing pick, quite frankly?
I mean, you're basically betting that
bankruptcies will continue.
It sure is, but, I mean, we have to go with the facts, and it looks like that's going to happen. And I believe this company will profit from that wave.
But Dave, there's legislation right now being talked about that would make it much, much, much more difficult to file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Is that something that you've considered?
I have considered it. Isn't that mainly for individuals, Kate, and not for corporations? Where this company caters strictly to corporations. And I believe the legislation is for individuals.
I was reading here that EPIC provides proprietary case management software to Chapter 7 liquidation, which is individuals.
EPIQ is the symbol. Dave, I want to ask you very briefly. We talked a little earlier about analysts and their recommendations, pro and con of certain stocks. Does that influence you when you take a look at a pick? If Mary Meeker or somebody has a strong buy or a buy, are you more likely to take a look?
No, I'm pretty independent. I will listen to what they say, but I often fade their picks, which means
they
going
take the
against
opposite
it.
Out of it. Yeah. So if they say buy, you might look to sell.
Correct.
And that
I have found historically that happens quite often.
Yeah, that ended up being a pretty profitable strategy last year. Well, thanks to Dave Goodboy, our resident stock picker. Once again, the stock is EPIQ Systems, EPIQ, the ticker, from MarketSurfer. He, of course, joins us every week here on E-Trade On Air with The Wave.
All right, let's turn to some stock talk and take a look at one company to watch in the upcoming week. Greg Temmel is market analyst and CEO Beyond the Bull, a website that gives market commentary and basically unscrambles all that financial jargon out there. Greg, let's zoom in on one stock you're watching for next week.
Well, we're going to zoom in on Oracle, Kate. There's absolutely no secret that Larry Ellison has brass. And all of last week, he was bashing the rivals that he so truly hates, IBM and Microsoft. And as far as Larry Ellison's concerned, last week they have unveiled the holy grail of new databases. They've unleashed a new product called the 9i, and they say flat out IBM and Microsoft will cease to be important parts of the database marketplace. Unbelievable the way this man talks, Kate.
Greg, he was quoted as saying some pretty outrageous things. One was, he said, your hardware costs, if you use IBM, will go through the roof and things such as that. But why didn't the stock see a bump? The stock actually was down a couple bucks for the week.
Because let's face it, next week we have to worry about earnings. On Monday the 17th, Oracle's going to come out with earnings. I'm surprised we haven't heard any earnings warnings over the last couple of weeks out of Oracle, and maybe that's one of the things that left Larry Ellison feeling a little bit more pompous last week. Maybe he knows that they're going to come out with some solid earnings. Of course, he'd have to know. And I'd be very surprised if he would have made these comments if he didn't have strong visibility on a going-forward basis, something that Intel was at least able to give us a little stability a couple of weeks ago. Maybe Oracle's going to do the same thing for software in the upcoming week. Most analysts have the stock rated a hold. No surprise. Most people are scared to death. It's fallen from about 46 about a year ago. It touched 13, hovering a little above that now, closed out last Friday just over $15 a share.
We always want to keep in mind, though, that Larry Ellison can be quite volatile, the chief executive officer over there. Let me ask you something, though.
Go ahead.
We know that the former chief operating officer, Ray Lane, has actually quit the company, and a Wall Street analyst over at Credit Suisse First Boston said that Larry Ellison is running things without former COO Ray Lane around, meaning there's no adult supervision. What do you think about that?
That's a great quote, but don't forget that Larry Ellison was there in the very, very beginning. He started the company, and hopefully we're going to get to see whether or not he can run this thing as well as he can run his mouth. We'll know next Monday night.
We've been speaking with Greg Temmel. He's CEO of BeyondTheBull.com.
Stock Talk is brought to you in part by IBM, taking e-business and your business to the next level.
stay close. We know you've been licking your lips with a Kool-Aid mustache to answer the ticker test. It's still to come here at E-Trade On Air from New York City.
I can't believe he's not coming. All he cares about is that car. Tell me about it.
Introducing the high-performance Lexus IS with chronograph-style instrumentation inside its race-inspired cockpit.
Where's Sophie?
She's at home.
You're kidding me.
The news that he's not coming was such a disappointment to her.
Oh, please. She's so naive.
The IS also features Formula One-style shifting, so you never have to take your hands off the wheel to shift gears.
Sophie should never have gone out with him.
Well, no one should.
Well, I shouldn't have.
Oh, I don't know what I was thinking either.
The IS even offers perforated Exane trim seating so the driver doesn't slide during hard cornering. Under the hood, the 3-liter engine has an innovative tuned induction system to maximize torque while VVT-i optimizes power.
I wish this lobster would pinch him.
Yeah, on his nose.
It's him!
Hey, stranger, sit here.
No, next to me. I insist.
The Lexus IS. Totally unexpected. Test drive one at your Lexus dealer or visit Lexus.com.
AIGDirect.com presents How to Cut Your Auto Insurance Rates. Useful tips on how you can save money when purchasing auto insurance. Be a safe driver. The best way to do that is to follow simple safety rules. Buckle up, follow cars at a safe distance, and don't speed. For more useful tips and a free auto insurance quote, visit AIGDirect.com. AIGDirect.com, the online source for buying auto insurance.
Frustrated by the IRS Schedule D and filing taxes for your investments? Let Gainskeeper.com help solve your capital gains tax headaches. Gainskeeper automatically adjusts for wash sales and corporate actions. Keep your gains. Log on to Gainskeeper.com today.
Our users come to us not only on a regular basis, but also during severe weather, whether it's snowstorms, landfall, hurricanes, tornadoes.
Weather.com is an IBM e-business.
I'm Mark Ryan, Chief Technology Officer of Weather.com, the internet arm of the Weather Channel.
As a top 25 website, Weather.com needs a top e-business infrastructure.
We may need to scale to 30 million page views within 2 days. We update our maps every 15 minutes in most cases.
IBM helps Weather.com on many fronts.
We needed a very robust infrastructure, hardware, software, but also the integration skills. IBM came to the table with their infrastructure parts, including Linux servers. We not only update the information, but also serve it back to our customers at a very high volume. IBM enabled us to achieve this goal.
Visit IBM.com/ebusiness for more information on IBM eBusiness infrastructure.
IBM is a valued infrastructure business partner of Weather.com.
Now, back to E-Trade On Air from the E-Trade Center in the heart of New York City at 55th and Madison with your host Jonathan Honig, Kate Bonner, and WebFN news anchor Tom Hudson.
Welcome back. Kraft Foods went public this week. Second biggest IPO or initial public offering in history. Closed on Friday at $30.64. That was actually below the IPO price. And guys, two differing analyst views on this one. Goldman Sachs has reportedly put a $25 price tag on Kraft. Others, like Bank of America, are valuing it as high as $33 a share. So, bit of split opinion on that one.
A little bit of the concern is the slow growth prospects in the food industry.
Not slow growth, however, is our ticker test, and that's coming up now. One of Kraft's brands, and one of my favorite, is Kool-Aid. There are 20 different flavors of Kool-Aid available, but which is the most popular? Is it A, Tropical Punch, B, Lemonade, C, Cherry, or D, Grape? We've gotten a lot of response at our email. That's etradeonair@etrade.com. But let's go around the table now. Kate, which is your favorite Kool-Aid brand?
I'm going to go with Grape because I think that that's the original flavor, right?
It's the mustache indicator. You got to go with the one that leaves the biggest
cherry,
mark on the upper lip. But listen, the cherry doesn't leave that mark.
Cherry
on the upper
is
lip all day
like
long.
The and our production staff, both in New York and Chicago, they're screaming cherry in my ear. They love it.
Listen, it's the grape that leaves the mark that lasts all day long.
All right. Well, the right answer actually came from Craig in Brooklyn. He guessed Tropical Punch, and that is the most popular flavor of Kool-Aid brand soft drink mix. Congratulations, Craig. You are the proud new owner of one of our E-Trade On Air t-shirts, and these are hot, beefy tees. So if you didn't win on this week's ticker test, no worries. Tune in next week and play along. That'll do it for this edition of E-Trade On Air. Be sure to join us for our weekly show and our weekday show, which is broadcast on the E-Trade website. We'll talk about iShares, these exchange-traded funds. Are they good investments, and how can you use them to beef up your portfolio? Plus, we'll talk with the author of The Attention Economy, Understanding the New Currency of Business. From the E-Trade Center in Midtown Manhattan, I'm Jonathan Honig with Tom Hudson.
And I'm Kate Bonner. Thanks for listening. And remember to click over to E-Trade's website Monday through Friday for our weekday broadcast. The show starts at 9 a.m. Eastern and is available all day on demand. Thanks for listening.
Before we go, our lawyers wanted us to tell you a few things about this show. The opinions expressed on E-Trade On Air are those of our contributors and not necessarily those of E-Trade Group Incorporated. Please keep in mind that these opinions do not constitute investment advice or recommendations from E-Trade Securities or E-Trade Group. Not all investments or investment strategies are suitable for all customers. Before you transact, get the facts. Do your research before you make any investment decision. This has been a production of E-Trade Group Incorporated. Copyright 2001. All rights reserved.